Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. Today's episode is inspired by our film, The Drafting of America's First Constitutions, a short documentary on the extraordinary decade from 1776 to 1787 that marked the most substantial period of Constitution writing in the history of the world in the newly formed United States of America. But how important are state constitutions today? Here to answer that question and more on the drafting of America's first constitutions is Judge Jeffrey Sutton, Chief Circuit Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and author of many books and essays on the very topic of state constitutions. Welcome to the show, Judge Sutton.
Thank you, Samantha. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Judge Sutton, why are state constitutions relevant, and who are they relevant to?
Yeah, so it's a very exciting time to be studying state constitutions. And, you know, they're relevant in quite a few ways. And let me just walk through a few of them. So one way in which state constitutions are very relevant today is what I call this second shot or two shot phenomenon. If one is unhappy with a state or local law or a state or local criminal prosecution, you have two shots, not one, to attack its validity. The one shot is the one we know quite a bit about, and that's using the federal constitution and provisions in the Bill of Rights, the 14th Amendment. But that shot doesn't always work. The Roberts Court is not the Warren Court. It occasionally innovates new rights, but certainly not at the pace the U.S. Supreme Court once did. So from time to time, you have situations where the U.S. Supreme Court essentially puts up a stop sign and says, you can't get relief under that claim. Take Rucho, the gerrymandering case. At that point, that means the litigant, the party, has just one other option, and that option is to go to state court and use state constitutions. And, you know, it turns out most Americans don't appreciate this. Most Americans don't know we have state constitutions. But most Americans don't appreciate that every individual right we care about in the federal constitution is either duplicated or has a counterpart guarantee that is similarly and sometimes even more extensively worded. And those can often provide valuable opportunities for relief. So that's one kind of practical explanation. I think the other reason state constitutions are highly relevant is they're very pertinent to figuring out the meaning of the federal constitution. So let's take the originalist who considers the original public meaning of the federal constitution to be what the judge is looking for and what we should be the most concerned about. It would be very strange to take originalism, original public meaning seriously and not be interested in state constitutions. And I say that so categorically because almost every one of these guarantees, and now we're talking structure and rights, but almost every one of them originated in those early state constitutions, sometimes even later state constitutions, and eventually added to the U.S. Constitution. So state constitutions, state court interpretations of those provisions can be very helpful in trying to figure out what the federal constitution means. I think a third one, a third explanation for taking state courts and state constitutions seriously in America circa 2022 is that, you know, we sometimes face just very difficult problems in government. You know, think of data privacy, the pandemic, the opioids crisis. And, you know, one wonderful insight that Justice Brandeis had is that when you have a difficult policy problem, a brave state can try one approach or another and ultimately become this laboratory of experimentation. Now, what Brandeis was referring to was the state legislatures as the laboratories of experimentation. But another way to think about it is – why would we leave it just to state legislatures? What's wrong with state courts construing state constitutions as another form of laboratory of experimentation? And what that allows is, instead of a, you know, race to Washington, top-down, winner-take-all approach to federal constitutional law, it permits percolation, experimentation in the state courts construing identical or similar guarantees in their state constitutions and allowing the experiment to unfold, and eventually for the federal courts and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court to decide whether to nationalize that right. And that leaves, I guess I would say for now, the last pretty potent reason for taking state constitutions seriously. And that's, you know, not everything has to have a uniform answer in this country. Arizona is different from Ohio. Florida is different from Montana. There's nothing wrong with Mississippi being different from California. And there are some features of our the histories of those regions or states, the culture, faith groups, you name it, even geography, can really make a difference in what the people want in a given region. And sometimes there's just nothing wrong in a country with 51 jurisdictions, 330 million people, of allowing different approaches to similar problems, just as we can have different tax structures in the 51 jurisdictions. Surely we can have different state constitutional rules. And, you know, we still have the federal constitution, the federal courts as a backstop. That's why it's two shots, not one.
Right.
But from time to time, I think it is quite appropriate for states to chart their own paths, and state constitutions are the charters that allow them to do that and offer evidence of what those constitutions mean.
That's the beauty of federalism, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the funny things is the state constitutions originated virtually every single thing in the federal constitution save one glaring thing, and that would be federalism, because of course the states were not dividing splitting the atom of sovereignty. They didn't have to do that at the time. That is what the federal constitution had to do. But everything else in the federal constitution, whether it's rights or structure, those ideas all percolated up from that first decade of experimentation, that first laboratory of constitutional experimentation from 1776, really up to the summer of 1787, although most of the experimentation was done by 1786.
I'd like to play an excerpt from our film, The Drafting of America's First Constitutions. Take a listen.
The U.S. Constitution drafted in 1787 did not write on a blank slate. The delegates to the U.S. Constitutional Convention of 1787 had available to them all kinds of written constitutions already on the state level.
In fact, one could make the argument that there's really only one patentable innovation in 1787, that's federalism, the idea of splitting the atom of sovereignty between the national government and the 13 states.
So that excerpt, I think, perfectly ties with what we were just discussing. What is the importance of state constitutions to this idea of federalism in the newly formed United States?
Well, you know, one of the early choices, we overlook this, or we jump over it, I guess, from time to time, is the idea of even writing constitutions. You know, England at the time famously had an unwritten constitution. So one really consequential choice at the outset is to decide that these charters should be written and the blueprint should be laid out for government. Then they also made the choice to guarantee rights. So they both empower different branches of government, governors, legislatures, courts. At the same time, they identify and enumerate rights that limit those different branches of government. So that's a really super interesting concept. The idea that it would be three branches of government that's all innovated at that point. And in fact, the early state constitutions didn't even agree on that. Some were really essentially two, where the courts were really going to be folded into the executive branch as they had essentially been in England. So I think that's all quite important. Then you start drilling down to some of the other experiments that unfolded. Would we have judicial review? So the U.S. Constitution famously is silent about that. Mm-hmm. Hamilton in Federal 78 assumed we would have judicial review. You know, proof that everyone would have expected the judicial power in Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution to include judicial review, the power of a court to invalidate laws or invalidate executive branch action, is the reality that the state courts had already been exercising judicial review before 1789. I mean, had John Marshall never been born, had the election of 1800 never happened, had there never been a Marbury or a Madison, this country still would have had judicial review. And I can say that so categorically because it had already been invented without controversy in the state courts. I mean, there was controversy in terms of responding to what state courts sometimes did, but the idea that they had this authority to dignify and respect the higher law, mm-hmm. the Constitution over a statute, everyone seemed to take largely for granted. So how judicial review would work is important from the state courts in terms of what it does for the federal Constitution. The executive branch, you know, famously has this unitary executive, one president. Everybody reports to the president, including the attorney general. And the states, quite famously, all have variations of plural executives where increasingly over time, separately electing attorney generals, secretaries of state, auditors, treasurers, even, you know, superintendents of insurance. And that was actually already unfolding early on. The federal drafters in Philadelphia in 1787 would have seen some models where there were state AGs that were separately selected and had kind of a separate authority from the governor. And that was a significant debate in Philadelphia. And I think ultimately the idea that the president had to be in charge of the military and you really wanted one energetic branch of government largely responsible for defending our borders is, I think, goes a long way to explaining why at the federal level we have the unitary executive. And bicameralism that comes out of the state constitutions. And of course, Congress has a House and a Senate. And, you know, we still have that in every state mm-hmm. except unicameral Nebraska. But yeah, so whether it's structure or rights, they all grow out of those experimentations. And, you know, some state constitutions were actually amended. You know, there were at least two of them before 1789. Pennsylvania is a good example. So they already had some trial and error before the federal drafters got down to business.
That leads me to my next question. What are the most interesting or foundational of the state constitutions? And was there anything radical proposed? It sounds like Nebraska is an interesting case being, you mentioned, the only unicameral state legislature.
Exactly. Yeah. So that doesn't come along. I think it's George Norris. That doesn't come along till 30s or 40s. It's a progressive idea, but seems to be it was enacted after the progressives held sway. But it was tried, I should point out, in quite a few other states. Mm-hmm. But it's only in Nebraska where it succeeded. So there's over time there've been quite a few innovations, which really show just a significant juxtaposition between the way the federal constitution organizes things and the way the state constitution organizes things. So one just really big one, it's a very big theme of who decides, mm-hmm. is how much more democratic state government has gotten over time and how essentially non-democratic the federal constitution and federal office holders and federal branches of government have remained. So a couple ways to illustrate that are with the era of Jackson, Jacksonian populism, the franchise gets extended to more and more people, happily, eventually no restrictions at all in voting except age and, you know, some mental capacity, but otherwise none. And as the franchise spreads, so does the number of times to use it. So a lot of the two states that started election of judges, you'll be surprised to hear, are, you know, not what you'd call twins separated at birth, but it's Mississippi and New York that get the idea of judicial elections going. And that has spread. 39 states have judicial elections. If you just take the total number of state judges in the country, 90% of them have to be elected or go back to the electorate at some point. That famously is not true at the federal level, where we have life tenure and appointments by the president, confirmation by the Senate. And then the plural executive, where you can vote for so many different offices, is another thing that just spread like wildfire across the states. And now the norm in the states is to have multiple elections for executive branch officials. And perhaps the most democratic feature of state constitutions is that half of them permit the people to essentially override a statute or a constitutional provision. Mm-hmm. So I think it's 18 states that have the initiative. So that means the people, once they get enough signatures, a group of citizens can put on the ballot of their state at their state election, a proposal to amend the Constitution, you know, take something out, add something to it. So that's over a third of the states there. And then if you add referenda, a referendum is a procedure that allows the people to modify or nullify a statute enacted by the legislature. That takes you to basically half the states have some form of what's called direct democracy. And that, of course, is a striking contrast to the way, you know, bicameralism, presentment to the president, and way laws are enacted at the federal level. So that too is, I guess I would call a really striking contrast. I'll tell you one fun story about how these plural executives can lead to all kinds of amusing, sometimes downright funny disputes. Is you sometimes will have, say, a governor of one political party and a significant executive branch official of another political party. So today, we see that most often with situations in which there's litigation and the governor's of one political party and has one position on the, say, validity of a federal law, and the attorney general of the same state is from a different political party and has the opposite view of, say, that federal law. And that's happened quite a bit the last 15 years or so in national litigation. And so you have these, you know, conflicts where people elected by the same folks in the same state have representatives in the executive branch that disagree about what to do. And so that's led to quite a few conflicts in healthcare, you know, the different litigation, immigration litigation, you name it. One amusing illustration of this was California has a separately elected governor and a separately elected lieutenant governor, which is a little strange because you can think of the lieutenant governor as sharing some of the qualities of a vice president. And, you know, early on in our country's history, it was possible to have a president of one party and a vice president of another party. That no longer is something that easily could happen. It can easily happen in the states where they have differently elected governors and lieutenant governors. And in California, Jerry Brown, it's the Jerry Brown you're thinking of, was running for president in 1980. He was the governor of California at the time, and his lieutenant governor apparently was a Republican. Mm-hmm. And the California Constitution said that if the governor leaves the state, the lieutenant governor has the governor's power, the executive branch power. And so Brown apparently is taking a trip to D.C. to do some fundraising or people meeting, whatever it is, for his campaign to be president in 1980. He was running in the primary. And he leaves the state, and the lieutenant governor of a different political party notices a vacancy in the California Supreme Court and tries to fill it while Brown is gone. And so, you know, Brown was not too amused, comes back, sues. The lieutenant governor wins the fight. The California Supreme Court said, you know, fair enough. It says if you leave the state, the lieutenant governor has the appointment power. But the lieutenant governor won the battle, but not the war, because the governor still had the power to undo the appointment if he did it within a certain amount of time. And sure enough, Governor Brown undid it within the right amount of time. So this poor fellow was a pawn. And I think he eventually got on the California Supreme Court several years later, but didn't last long that time.
Interesting. So going back to the format of these constitutions, how closely is the U.S. Constitution related to any of these founding state constitutions?
Well, you know, what's so fun about we all know these framers of the federal Constitution, the Miracle at Philadelphia, and so they all have personalities that we know, and many of them went on to very significant roles, of course, in the federal government. And so that's how we think of the story. The story starts for a lot of us in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia and goes forward from there. And I think the thing that we sometimes miss is that the most formative experiences for the folks that showed up in Philadelphia in 1787 was their work in writing, negotiating state constitutions. I mean, John Adams famously wrote the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, and surely an experience like that is really going to inform what you decide is appropriate for the federal document. Even though you realize the federal government's different, some of the ideas are going to be the same no matter what kind of government, whether national or state. And it didn't matter whether you were a Federalist or anti-Federalist. Either way, that was your formative experience, because there were Federalists and anti-Federalists involved basically in all of the state constitution's formulations. So, you know, that's basically what you might call the miracle of Philadelphia in 1787 is not so much that they wrote a federal constitution. I would call the miracle that no one appreciates where they got all these ideas. I mean, it's a lot of cutting and pasting, mm-hmm. as the Virginians would say, why don't we use this feature of our constitution? Those from Pennsylvania saying, what about ours? And those from Massachusetts saying, what about theirs? And so that really was the key building blocks. Now, of course, as they had to compromise and negotiate, I think it's fair to say the state experiences and the state models got less and less helpful, because there were some unique things they had to do with the national constitution. Figuring out how to make federalism work being a pretty good example. And then one other thing that people sometimes forget, because this is such a striking difference between the way the federal and state constitutions work, is Madison and Jefferson agreed on basically everything. I mean, they're from Virginia. They're both from Virginia. Their estates are, 20 miles apart. Mm-hmm. They are sequential presidents. Madison serves in Jefferson's cabinet. They both have really big roles to play with significant documents in American history, whether it's the Declaration, the Bill of Rights, notes at the Philadelphia. And ultimately, they agree on really most of the big picture issues in American government. But the one thing that they conspicuously disagreed about was how often constitutions should be amended. And Jefferson took the view that each generation should be in charge of its own destiny, and generations are roughly 19 to 20 years. So what he thought should happen with all constitutions is you ought to have a convention every 20 years and review, reassess, and if need be, make plenty of changes if that generation wanted them. Madison was very worried about frequent amendments or ease of amendability, because he thought it ran the risk that the Constitution would not be respected, and that you want to venerate a Constitution, and veneration occurs when something has been around for a long time as opposed to something that's frequently changed. So these two Virginians that agreed about just about everything completely disagreed on amendability. Hmm. And the verdict 245 years or so later is Jefferson was dramatically correct, or dramatically won the argument for the state constitutions, and Madison clearly won the argument for the federal. So on the state side, almost every constitution can be amended by 51% vote or so. There's procedural limitations on how that vote gets to the people, for sure, but 51% is not a high threshold. I think the highest one is Florida's at 60%, maybe Colorado 55%, but at all events, most are 51%, and a few a little more, and some with more procedural limitations than others. What that has meant is that at the state side, constitutional amendments are this, I mean, there's 5,600 of them, there's 350 conventions. Wow. So they're like this perfect, like almost archaeological study of American history, because every wave of history is reflected in these constitutions, which are so easily amended to reflect the policy preferences of the day. And so that's why the state constitutions just keep getting more and more democratic and more different from the federal constitution over this long period of time. By contrast, Madison wins the federal debate, and the Articles of Confederation could only be amended with 100% support, every state agreeing to do it. And in Article 5 of the federal constitution, they made it 3/4. So they lowered it, but still left it very high. So, you know, getting 3/4 of the states to approve an amendment today is considered pretty daunting for anything remotely controversial. And so it can be quite difficult to change the meaning of the federal constitution, which is why it's remained so Republican, sometimes non-democratic. It has the Electoral College, two states, two senators from each state. Judicial review is not very non-democratic. Life tenure federal judges, very non-democratic. So you've got all these non-democratic features of the federal constitution, while the state constitutions just get more and more hyper-democratic.
What states have the most traditional or original versions of what was originally drafted? And what states have the most evolved or progressive or modern or amended versions of their constitutions?
Yeah, it's I can't give you the exact ones. I mean, but I can say this, the federal constitution has roughly 7,500 words. It's hard to find too many state constitutions with 7,500 words. I want to say maybe Missouri and Virginia are examples, but they're just a few. It's a small handful that, well, I would say look like a constitution. In other words, they're sparing. They don't constitutionalize everything. The norm is, I mean, I think the average for state constitutions is 30,000 words or in that area. Wow. So think of that, 30,000 words versus 7,500. Justice Black used to like to carry around the federal constitution in his breast pocket wherever he went. And, you know, you try to do that with a state constitution, you need a backpack and or maybe more. California and Alabama, I think, are two of the largest, longest in the world. And I think they might even be over 100,000 words. Wow. Alabama, because I think you need constitutional amendments when you're dealing with provisions that affect county government, which is kind of a strange phenomenon, but it leads to more constitutional amendments. And California is a very good example of a state with the initiative, and Californians have used the initiative quite often. So that would explain, you know, the expansion of there.
Does a longer constitution make a judge's job more difficult or arduous, or does it make it easier?
Oh, that's such a great question. So I could actually see it being easier. Like, let's think about the big debate in, we'll call it federal con law today. The big debate in federal con law is when judges interpret the federal constitution, should they think of these guarantees as having a fixed meaning, which is what originalist textualists believe, or do these guarantees, particularly the generally worded ones, have an evolving meaning, a fluid meaning, one that can have different meanings over different periods of time? Now, one reason at the federal level there's been so much pressure to have what I'll call creative theories of interpretation, often evolving meaning interpretations, it's so difficult to amend the federal constitution. And so even though there are few words, they happen to be words that were almost all written in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is difficult for federal judges. It's difficult, even for the originalists, it's difficult to know what an 18th century provision means. I mean, you have history and we'll have the adversarial process, we'll bring in historians, but who's going to say it's easy? Mm-hmm. The state constitutions, because they're so easy to amend, in some ways make this debate between originalism and living constitutionalism look silly. Like, who needs to have a constitution that can evolve over time through judicial interpretation when the people can amend it themselves so easily? It just kind of doesn't make sense. So I don't really care for the frequent amendability of state constitutions. I don't care for the fact that they're often, you know, I think too many provisions in these state constitutions. Mm-hmm. If you constitutionalize everything, you run the risk of constitutionalizing nothing, mm-hmm. of, you know, not even distinguishing it as a constitution. But for the judge, I suppose it's perhaps easier because the people will have had many opportunities to clarify what they mean by a guarantee, maybe spell it out a little more clearly than a counterpart federal guarantee. So it's possible it is easier. You know, one thing I would say about, you know, one thing that people care about in constitutions a lot is, you know, our rights. Mm-hmm. We Americans love our traditionally enforceable individual rights. And a fun fact about the state constitutions is almost all of them start their constitution with rights. In other words, before they get into, you know, what's in the executive branch, how do you vote for these people, what's the blueprint of government look like, the very first thing they do is they have their declarations of rights where they explain what this soon to be described government can't do. So they really prioritize rights, which shows, I think, confirms American history, political preferences have a real libertarian rights protective approach, whether it's liberty, property, equality. So they kind of start there. Whereas the federal constitution, famously the Bill of Rights, comes later. But the one thing I was going to say, when it comes to construing the federal Bill of Rights and the state declarations of rights, a lot of those guarantees are still fairly generally worded. Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, it's not going to be necessarily simple at the state level to construe them. I mean, most state constitutions have an unreasonable search and seizure guarantee, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that's any easier for a state court judge to construe than a federal judge.
What do you think is easier to amend or change, a written constitution or a verbal constitution?
Yeah, well, the famously in England, whatever Parliament did essentially became part of the unwritten constitution, at least in certain areas. And I suppose in a way you could argue that's easier. I guess if I had to put my finger on one thing that I consider somewhat unsettling about American government is this reality of the federal constitutions, which of course are written. Federal constitution, which is written, its provisions are all written. I don't think there's been a court in world history that embraces judicially enforceable rights, judicial review, more than the U.S. Supreme Court. And if there are other courts, you know, I don't know them, but at a minimum, we're leaders. We're either in the pole position or we're one of the leaders in world history of having a court at the federal level that really embraces judicially enforceable rights. Mm-hmm. And what I consider unsettling is we not only have that, but we then have another feature of our federal constitution, and that's that it's one of the most difficult to amend in the world. The 75% state threshold is really hard. I mean, I've already explained the state constitutions aren't that difficult. I think Australia's might be close to 75, if not 75, mm-hmm. but most countries' constitutions are amendable more easily than 75%. And think of that, what that means. You take those two things together. You have a federal court system where they frequently exercise judicial review, but it's almost impossible to correct by amendment. That's the normal way you would think of correcting a decision you didn't like. And then the third leg of the stool, you might say, is that the only other recourse is selection of judges, but because they're not elected and they have life tenure, it's very random when that opportunity comes along.
Right.
You know, people could die. People, you don't know who's going to be president, who's in control of the Senate. And so what I consider unsettling, and one reason I really favor using state courts and state constitutions for our as first responders and innovating rights, is at the state level, the stakes just aren't as high. So first of all, it's a smaller jurisdiction. The Ohio Supreme Court's smaller than U.S. Supreme Court's jurisdiction. But if the people of a state don't care for a decision, easier to correct, usually a 51% vote, 90% of state court judges come back to the ballot box at some point. So if the people are frustrated, they can do it that way. The only state in the country that has the same appointment confirmation system and life tenure is actually the smallest jurisdiction, Rhode Island. Mm. So isn't that amusing? Rhode Island and the United States both have life tenure and the selection system. The other states, even the ones that have a don't have elections, they have age caps. So, you know, age 70, 75. So that, you know, again, is a way in which judicial power is limited. So I'm not against the federal system. I just wonder if we've got it backwards, that we're doing too much of our innovation initially through the federal courts and federal constitution, and might be wise to think of state courts and state constitutions as a useful, you know, first responder, the initial place you look when you're dealing with a new policy problem that might implicate individual constitutional rights.
So you wrote two books on this subject. One is called Who Decides? States as Laboratories of Constitutional Experimentation, and another, 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law. Why did you write these two books, and who is your audience for them?
Yeah, so I did not know a lot about state constitutions. Didn't study it in law school. Didn't really learn about it until I became the Ohio Solicitor General and became responsible for defending challenges to state and local laws in the Ohio Supreme Court, and suddenly realized that state constitutions did provide a second shot, that often could be a productive shot and a significant way to protect rights. So one example in 51 Imperfect Solutions of that is school funding. So in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court put up a stop sign when it came to a claim under the 14th Amendment that there ought to be equal opportunity between rich and poor school districts when it came to the quality of the public school education provided in a state. And the U.S. Supreme Court rejected that claim in 1973 in a 5-4 decision. And after 1973, the litigation shifted to the states and state constitutions. And it's almost 3/4 of the states that at one point had their state court recognize a state constitutional guarantee to some form of adequacy in school funding or even equality in school funding. So I found myself just really thinking, well, this is important, and we Americans should think about this a little more. A second reason I wrote the books is I feel like we're living in under the danger of a single story, or the peril of a single story, which that single story is there's one court that protects our rights interpreting one constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court interpreting the U.S. Constitution. And, you know, that's a misleading story. It's inaccurate. There are 51 constitutions. There are 51 high courts. Mm-hmm. All 51 can protect our rights, theoretically, through two shots, particularly when it comes to state and local laws. And single stories generate myths. And one myth that has grown out of this single story is the idea that the U.S. Supreme Court always gets it right. Mm. And another myth is the states always get it wrong. And so one story I tell in these books is about the eugenics movement, where the U.S. Supreme Court, I think most people would strongly agree, made a mistake in Buck versus Bell when they said that states could pass eugenics laws, which allowed them to involuntarily sterilize individuals with mental disabilities, who've been accused of crime, and other, you know, it covered all kinds of alleged disabilities, and some of them weren't disabilities at all. It was really quite striking. And famously in Buck versus Bell, with, you know, our best known U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes writing for the court, 8-1, they upheld these laws. And so that proves, one, the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't always get it right. But the other part of that story that no one seems to appreciate is that the state courts largely got that issue right. So there have been quite a few state court decisions. Smith's a good example from the New Jersey Supreme Court, in which the same types of claims were presented to the state court, some under state constitution, some under the federal constitution. But the key is these are all before Buck versus Bell. Mm. The key is that in most of them, the state courts vindicated the individual's challenge to these eugenic laws. So I really think that's an important important side of this, you know, the story. I think the first book, 51 Imperfect Solutions, really is focused on individual rights. And the second book, Who Decides, deals with what I think is more important over the long haul, and that's structure. Rights in a constitution are just parchment guarantees, in Madison's words, if there's no place to enforce them. You don't have dependable courts to judicially enforce a right that's in a state or federal constitution. And so Who Decides deals with the structure of government, how it's set out, spends a lot of time on the proper role of the state and federal courts, and potentially the significant role state courts can play in protecting rights, deals with amendments, the executive branch, and we can talk in a little bit of, it's got a whole chapter on administrative law, which is, really important topic right now in American statutory and constitutional law. So I think the main reason to sum it all up is I felt we were living in a American legal system that had just lost track of this other side of the story, that their 50 state constitution, there's the source code of most of what's in the federal constitution, and they provide this second opportunity to protect rights separate from the federal constitution. And they provide this second source of experimentation, whether with structure or rights, in figuring out, you know, what is the best way to run a government, protect liberty, honor equality, dignity of human beings, and so forth.
I think Buck's a great example. And a quick plug, we're actually in pre-production on a documentary on Buck v. Bell this year. So great. Thanks for mentioning that one. How would you look at Buck v. Bell in this case? So most people, if you read the case, you would think, okay, so Carrie Buck is going to the Supreme Court to appeal something that she thinks is unjust at the state level, and the court sided with state law. What should this, you know, what is your take on that? Where did things go wrong? And, or is this just an example of federalism? Like, maybe some people would say, Buck, as immoral a decision as it is, and to remind our listeners, that's the one where Oliver Wendell Holmes said, three generations of imbeciles is enough, and discussing the legal sterilization of Carrie Buck on the grounds that she was declared an imbecile, whatever that means. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, factually, as I point out in the book, Holmes was three times wrong. The evidence actually doesn't support that a single one of them was an imbecile, however you wanted to define it at that point. So that's really unfortunate. You are right that case came through the state courts. The problem with the litigation in that case, as I lay out in the chapter on Buck v. Bell, is that the it really had the feel of collusive litigation, to be honest with you. The lawyer that was ostensibly working for Kerry Buck had previously been on the board of what was called the colony where she was living. So, I mean, you didn't even really have an adversarial process. Now, what should happen today, and happily, a eugenics law could not pass today because all 50 states have anti-discrimination laws when it comes to disabilities, and involuntary sterilization of individuals with disabilities would clearly violate those laws. And nationally, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act from 1990. So happily, that couldn't be repeated today. But, you know, the thing that I find a little bit sad, I mean, Justice Holmes' opinion is like three paragraphs of an quote analysis, you know, seemed to be a little more in love with his language and slogans than with any real analysis. He doesn't cite any of the state court cases. I mean, doesn't, and they were cited. I've read the briefs. I mean, they were cited to the court, and he doesn't mention any of them in his opinion. And to me, what should happen in a case like this, and, you know, let's be fair, it was 1927, and a lot of people were caught up in this eugenics movement, and it's almost 100 years later. And my point is not to indict them. I'm allowed to disagree with it and say it was wrong. But yeah, I think your question is the right one. Like, how do we avoid this going forward? I mean, you can always have a eugenics movement, or you can always have something that initially seems sensible, initially seems to respond to some perceived emergency. And over time, it takes, unfortunately, too much time, we realize the mistake that was made. And that to me is the beauty of two shots. And, you know, what the Buck versus Bell story illustrates is that state courts can get these issues right sometimes, including times when the federal courts don't get them right. And so that leads to the question, well, Jeff, okay, I accept two shots is better than one. I mean, it just sounds like a free throw analogy in basketball, but it, you know, are they really two independent shots? And can you really trust state court judges to protect counter-majoritarian rights at times the federal courts haven't? And then some people will say, and if 90% of these judges are elected at the state level, aren't they going to be less inclined to respect, dignify counter-majoritarian rights? And the answer is, don't give up so quickly. One thing about state court judges that I think parties and litigants have shortchanged and not appreciated is how elections often sensitize them to what's going on in the ground. Now, I don't want to be unfair to federal judges, being one, that seems self-inflicted. But the reality that once you're confirmed and you do not have to run for office again, you know, you have no explanation or incentive to be traveling around, say, the state of Ohio to Lincoln dinners, bar association meetings. I mean, it's a good idea when you're invited to do these things, but it's not surprising that a state court judge who's elected is going to go to a lot more of those because they need to stay in office. Now, you might say electioneering hurts them in terms of independence and counter-majoritarian rights, but I think there are lots of ways in which that's just not true. You know, if you're a state court judge who's very familiar with your local community, you have to be to stay in office, you might actually learn on the ground who these people are that are being involuntarily sterilized. It's not an abstract issue for you the way it might have been for Holmes in the 1927 U.S. Supreme Court. It's like you might know the superintendent of that institution. You might, in your campaign efforts, have met people with a disability who are subject to this kind of law. So I actually think the two shots thing works really well precisely because a lot of state court judges have different experiences, sometimes even more experience in government. Sometimes elections helps them. And then the last point is, at a minimum, a state court judge is surely going to really know their state. I mean, they're invested in that for sure. And I think that can sometimes help. So, you know, to me, this is just a really underappreciated feature of American government and how we can look after rights, slow things down when a movement maybe is getting ahead of itself and has not been thought through well enough, as in eugenics. But, you know, who can disagree with a second shot? And who can disagree with a second shot when the first shot, you know, is not allowed? I mean, sometimes the U.S. Supreme Court just puts up a stop sign. And when they do that, there's only one thing left, state constitutions. You'd think that would make sense to a fair number of people.
Are there any famous state constitution writers worth noting? If I recall, Mason is one. Are there any big names that our listeners might be interested in learning about who wrote these state constitutions?
Yes, Mason for sure. John Adams. I mean, John Adams is really central to the Massachusetts 1780 Constitution. I think Franklin, believe it or not, I think was involved in Pennsylvania's, not exclusively. But if one looked at the framers at Philadelphia, looked at the state they were from, and then just looked at their biography, I think you'd see, I wouldn't be surprised if it's at least half had a role in their state constitutions. Anyway, it would be a significant number. So if it's not half, it'd be a significant plurality.
You wrote an essay, Why Teach and Why Study State Constitutional Law. Why should law school students study state constitutional law? What is your thesis there?
Well, I think for the young lawyer, it's a really exciting time to learn state constitutions. First of all, if your colleagues in your law firm, your prosecutor's office, your public defender's office, wherever it is you're practicing, if your colleagues are over 35, the odds are high they don't know a lot about state constitutions because they just have not had a role to play. And it's probably worth explaining why they've become more relevant recently. The two-shot opportunity doesn't arise until incorporation in the 1950s and 60s when the U.S. Supreme Court makes most of the Bill of Rights applicable to the state. So that's when the opportunity to attack a state or local law or state or local criminal prosecution becomes two opportunities, not one. And then the second thing to point out is that with the Warren Court, there really wasn't a need for state court innovation because the Warren Court was just so energized. I mean, they really were on a mission to protect a lot of liberties and equal protection rights that they thought were being underappreciated. Well, today's court is not the Warren Court. Today's court is not only not innovating as much, but there are times in which they're reversing earlier decisions. And so we suddenly are in a world in which this second state shot is just really material and really significant. So that's, you know, the idea becoming a lawyer is to try to win cases and help your clients. And this is a second way to do it. The other reason I think state constitutions are become quite salient today is originalism is become such a significant and influential theory of constitutional interpretation. It was the prevailing theory before the Warren Court, but it's taken a long time for it to become salient again. And I don't understand how someone can take original public meaning seriously and not pay attention to state constitutions and their interpretation by state courts. If you doubt me, read Justice Scalia's opinion in Heller, the Second Amendment right to bear arms case, where the key analytical move in the case in deciding whether the Second Amendment protects an individual right as opposed to solely a collective right, his key move is to look at the state right to bear arms provisions, noting how they're all individual rights, and he's quite right about that. And so I think that's just super helpful. And I can illustrate this just one other way. I'll try to use a topic that if you're a law student, I'd be just stunned you're not spending some time thinking about, and right now all American lawyers are paying a lot of attention to it, is administrative law. So the federal administrative law story is very focused on at least two issues. One is whether there ought to be judicially enforceable non-delegation doctrine, which is the idea that there ought to be some limits on how broadly Congress can delegate its policymaking power to, say, a federal agency. And in the Gundy case, the U.S. Supreme Court did not judicially enforce the non-delegation doctrine, but it was a very close debate. And you certainly got the sense that this was something the nine justices were thinking seriously about. The second area is Chevron, the idea that ambiguous federal statutes can be finally construed by an agency, and the federal courts have to defer to those agency interpretations as long as they're reasonable. Now, that too has generated a lot of debate. There's been some decisions that have cut back on Chevron, but it's just this really vibrant debate about whether this is appropriate at the federal level. Well, here's state constitutionalism and state statutory law is just so fascinating because here the state courts have not followed either federal example. So roughly 43 states have long judicially enforced the non-delegation doctrine. The sky has not fallen. And most states do not defer to agency interpretations of state statutes. I think only two states have incorporated Chevron by name. Maybe just 10 states have got a form of a deference regime, but at the state level, they're all over this. Florida recently amended its constitution to prohibit deference to agencies. Mississippi Supreme Court said it violated the Mississippi separation of powers provisions to have deference to agencies. Arizona and Wisconsin eliminated deference to agencies by statute. And I guess the upshot of all of this is we suddenly are left with this world, and you can't appreciate it if you don't see both sides of the story, the federal and state side. But now think of the upshot. The upshot is we have the broadest delegation regime at the federal level, express delegations or implied delegations of policymaking power to federal agencies. So we have the broadest delegation at the federal level to the agencies with the most power. And so that seems kind of strange because you think it might be the reverse. I mean, the entity with the most power, you might expect to have the most restrictions or the most process limitations. And the other oddity is there's obviously really big incentives to go to the federal agencies and Congress because you not only can have one agency doing a lot of things you might care for, but you're now end running these 50 state regimes that put all these hurdles in front of delegations or agency deference. So there's a really good example of if you understand state constitutional law, you'd be able to make some arguments that would be really relevant to the federal debate. And you know, that's one of my favorite features of state constitutionalism. It's not really a separate sphere. It's really a dialogue between the states and feds, and they both can kind of shine quite a bit of light on each other, and that light can be really helpful for state and federal judges in trying to figure out what these constitutions mean.
I'm going to make another plug here for two documentaries from FedSoc Films, Chevron, Accidental Landmark, and a follow-up mini-doc, Chevron, Scalia's Evolution. So if you want to learn more about Chevron without reading and watching a FedSoc film, you can check those out. I have one more question for you. What is your advice for law school students who are interested in constitutional law, whether it's federal level or the state level?
Yeah, so I could go on for quite a while, but let me give you a couple ideas on this one. So I think clerking is a really nice idea, and you're not going to be surprised to hear that I think clerking at the state court level is a wonderful idea, particularly if you think it's likely you're going to stay in that state. You know, what a great mentor if you would be to have a state Supreme Court justice as someone you've worked for, and you can now live in the same state, maybe even the same city as your career evolves and unfolds. So I think clerking at federal and state level is wonderful. Both sets of courts get plenty of constitutional cases, particularly if you're clerking in an appellate court. So that's a really nice way to do it. You know, one thing I might recommend is once the student takes the bar, once they're in a state, you know, it's good advice to the young lawyer to look for opportunities to speak and write. Obviously, you have to take care of your practice and whatever it is your responsibilities are with your job, they come first, after family, faith, and all of that. But obviously, when it comes to the job, you got to take care of that. But one way to grow a practice, one way to get your name out there is to volunteer to speak or write for local journals, law reviews, you name it, even newspaper editorials. And so then you got to think, well, what am I going to write about? Well, let me just tell you an open field, because this is what I've done for the last 15, 20 years. There is so much to say about your state constitution, I just promise you. And you could decide to look at one particular, maybe you really care about free exercise, and maybe your state court has not really examined the history of this guarantee, where it came from, how it's been construed. Well, that's a pretty fun article to write, a pretty fun speech to give. And by the way, going to be eventually very helpful for your state court, maybe even for your clients, and maybe even for developing business. So, you know, everyone gets the advice, go out and speak and write. What they don't tell you is what to speak and write about. And, you know, if you choose to speak and write about the federal constitution, the problem you're going to run into is it's got a lot of people in the field. It's
saturated
like
market.
Opening day. It's like opening day on a river just after they stock the fish. You're elbow to elbow, whereas the state constitutions are basically a beautiful river in Wyoming where you can't see anyone for 2 miles, and lots of things to catch and tell people about. And so I just think it's a wonderful area to write and speak about and research. And I can guarantee you, having spoken to a lot of state court judges over the last decade or so, they're actually really interested in the help. In other words, the help being some articles that explain the history of some of these documents, because, you know, this will be my last point, and I guess it's a state court point, but we not only don't tell both sides of the story, but what's amusing is we forget the side of the story where most cases are filed. So there's different ways to measure these things, but I'll just give you a couple numbers to show it. If you look at just criminal cases, the number of criminal cases filed in the last year for which we have numbers is 17 million, roughly, all 50 states. The counterpart federal court number is 70,000. So 17 million, 70,000. That's apples to apples because it's the geographic United States. I think the counterpart number, when you do all civil and criminal, so, you know, traffic tickets, you name it, I think it's 83 million to 400,000. So, you know, if you care about the rule of law, you care about constitutional law, it's either being taken care of in the state courts or it's not being taken care of, because that's where most activity in the courts occurs. And those 17 million criminal cases, those 83 million civil and criminal cases in the state courts, those are all cases where state constitutions could make a difference. Federal constitutions can make a difference there too, but I'm just making the point, that's a lot of cases where the second shot could make a difference. And that ought to be really exciting to the law student and young lawyer trying to make a difference in this great career.
I'm not a lawyer, but that sold me. If I was a lawyer, I'd be very interested in state constitution.
Oh, Samantha, there's still time. Oh, don't
not
give up
yet.
On this one.
Can still go to law school. It's never too late. Well, that was really great. Thank you for all that. I really appreciate you joining us today, Judge Sutton, for another episode of the FedSoc Films podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Samantha. It's an honor to be with you.
Our guest today is Judge Jeffrey Sutton, Chief Circuit Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. You can check out the film, The Drafting of America's First Constitutions, on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.